The main reason to be here tonight is really just to honor Lama Ora and have a baby shower. And then she talked me into saying something about parenting, which I know nothing about. but I've heard things. So I talked to some close friends who are, I consider, very good parents and successful parents. And then the last thing we said, I said, well, okay, I'll have to talk about something I know nothing about, but I'm okay at, I'm pretty good at that. So anyway, I think the first thing I'd like to say is, I remember going with some parents, friends who are parents, and we went to Tucson to see His Holiness, I think 1998 or something? I don't remember.
93.
When was it?
It was in 93.
Sure.
That was when I met you.
Oh. In Tucson?
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
But we went again.
We went again
after the three retreat.
You came again.
That was in 2005 or something.
Oh, no. It must have been 1993 or something. I don't know. Anyway.
No, but then there was one we went. Maybe it was 98.
I don't know. But we went, and then I remember he was teaching Master Shantideva, and one of my friends had a chance to, you know, you submitted questions, and somebody submitted a question to him, and it was, you know, how to, he was teaching patience, that was 1993, and they said, well, how do you teach these things to children? And then I remember his response was very beautiful. It was, he said, you can't teach these things to children. All you can do is give them an example. And then, you know, my friend's face fell. And then I was thinking also, this is the hard way, you know? Like, he said a beautiful thing. He said, children are not gonna listen to you, and it doesn't matter what you say to them or how much you explain to them. They're just gonna, in the end, they'll end up doing what you're doing, you know? And I found that as a teacher, you know, like I've spent most of my adult life teaching people. But in the end, they just do what you do. So I think first of all, that's a good advice to me. It seems like a good advice to me. I think one of the main things you could teach children by example is how you view the world and how you view other people, right? And on a beginning level, I think you're not too much in control of your mind, and you're not very good at practicing worldview, and so you lose it. So I think on a beginning level, especially if you're about to have children or something, you're going to have children, then I think you would have to be in the mindset that probably you're not going to be able to keep your patience. Probably you're going to lose patience. And then your children are going to see you lose patience with other people. Probably inevitably, right? But also especially with them. And then... I think children watch. So what I mean to say is, they're going to see you get angry. The children will see you lose it, and I don't think at that point that you can change it much. You know, you're not going to be perfect, and you're going to lose your patience with what they do. And then I think that the crucial thing is, they will watch what you do afterwards. You know, they will watch how you deal with having lost it, and how long do you hold the anger, and how long does it take you to apologize and forgive them, right? So they will watch, and then I think for people at our level who lose it sometimes, or we can't be perfect people, then I think one of the most important lessons to teach children is how quickly you forgive, you know? How quickly you can let go of anger. And then how quickly, whether or not you can be the first person to make up you know, or to hug the other person and say, you know, the courage to apologize to people or to admit that you were wrong. And so I'm thinking on first level, in as far as you can, to show how fast you can forgive and how fast you can get over something, you know, is that maybe that's one of the most important lessons to teach children. Then on a second level, using karma and emptiness with your children, right? So parents are always having expectations of what their children will be. I think a lot about having a child is, and also having a disciple, is expectations of what you want them to be. And it, for me, it's very, very strong. With the people who are close, and the people I train closely, like I have very, very extreme expectations of them. And then, what will you do when they don't meet those expectations, you know? Because, I mean, are you going to be the kind of parent who gets angry at them or berates a child for not meeting what you expect, you know? Because you're going to have this idea of who they should be. I was in, what do you call it? We're going to Princeton tomorrow to do a little concert and a little talk. And then people sent me a newspaper clipping, and it said, it was about our going there. And it was interesting to me because it was I'm from the university, so they were talking about my life and stuff, you know? Then I flipped the article over and there was singles ads, you know, on the back, and it said, if you're going to be my partner, you have to be the fun, you know? And there is a list of things, you know? But what caught my eye was the you have to be, you know, like it just, some guy was demanding already, before he met the lady, he was demanding what she would be, you know? And I was just wondering who would answer that kind of thing, you know? Like, you will have to be, you know? And that's kind of how we feel, I think, as a parent, or as a teacher also. You have a certain vision of what you want the person to be. And then you start, because you're bigger than them, you get to direct them. And, you know, in a way you're expected to direct them and you're supposed to decide for them how they're supposed to be. And then you're supposed to sort of push them in that direction. And then what if they don't want to go, you see? And what if that's not them? What if that's not what they want to be? So I'm thinking, you know, nowadays, we've been in China a lot, and they start now training children for college in preschool, you know? Like the college education prep in China occurs in preschool. So you are sending your kids, you know, this is like 3 years before first grade, and you're sending the children to learn alphabet and learn English and learn math, and by the time they hit school, what we would call elementary school, he's got real practice. By the time you reach elementary school, they're already telling, you're supposed to be already forcing the child into getting a head start and being ahead of the other children, right? So it's this competitive thing. And then it's like drilled into their minds that getting into college is so competitive in China that you're gonna have to be prepping in preschool, and you have to get a head start during preschool to be serious college candidate, you know, like that. And I like to think of children, and maybe also Dharma people, as I like to use the word ether. Their mind is like the ether. So I believe that people come into this life was sort of unformed mind, a mind that's not completely formed yet, and they're in an uneducated way, but also in the sense of their mind is almost more attuned to a greater nature. I don't know how to say it. Their mind is free, in a way. In a way, their mind is in some kind of freely creative state. Before you hit school, before you hit free before you hit formal education, your mind is in some sort of an open, available, and I like to think of it as ether, right? And then you hit school. I remember first grade, because my family moved when I was in first grade. So I went from a church school in Santa Monica. They put me in public school in Arizona, and I remember being in first grade, and the first day I remember. And they gave me a big piece of that cheap paper with the dotted lines and the lines. Really cheap paper. It's like what Doubleday uses for my books now. And probably better. The teacher said, okay, everybody draw a big A on your paper. You know? So write a big A on your paper. So I'm thinking, I'm like, pause, you know, and I'm like, maybe she wants a capital A, but she didn't say capital A. She said big A. So probably she wants a big A, you know? So I drew this A as big as the paper, because I thought if she wanted a capital A, she would have said capital A. And then she walked around, you know, desk to desk and nodding. This is Mrs. Melvin, you know her. With the far side glasses and the bee, what do you call it?
Behind.
Yeah, just like that. And then she leans over, you know, and she says, what? She got angry, you know, she really criticized me, you know, this, I wanted a big A, you know, and I'm like, I remember looking up, you know, really up, high, you know, and saying, you know, it is a big A. And then she thought I was being a smart aunt, you know, and, you know, so, when you hit first grade, normally, then they start demanding that you conform to a certain idea of what they want, and where things were ethereal before, and where creativity and nature dominated before, now they want to restrict your movement, and they want to, how do you say, buttonhole you. They want to put you in a box. Nowadays they say in a box, right? And they want you to conform to a certain idea of, in this case, communicating. You know, you have to write the letters in a certain way, and then you have to speak in a certain way, and you must spell them in a certain way. And other ways of spelling them are wrong, you see? And then I responded to it well, you know? Like, I like order. And I like being told, you know, being told to make your A like this, or I feel comfort in structure, right? Even if it's an imposed structure, and even if it may not be the best structure, to be structured is comfortable. It gives me comfort, okay? And then, but what happens is, the moment you start structuring a child's development with letters and things like that, then you are destroying the natural in them, right? The natural mind. The mind which is more free and available and creative. And then you're forcing that mind into certain molds from a certain age. So call it, I don't know, 7 or 6, first grade? And so if you start that process earlier, artificially, if you say, my kid has to get ahead of the other kids, and I want my kid to be able to learn letters and numbers earlier than the other kids, and this is big in China right now, right? Real pressure, and even intelligent children in China are being they get tutoring. Like they come from a hard day of school and then they're required to do some French or some, you know, like they're, or do algebra or something. They get pressed more. So then I think my feeling is that most children will pick up numbers and letters easily when they hit first grade. So it's okay. You can just let them do that. And then some of them won't anyway. And maybe that's what I'm thinking recently a lot about is people I know who never really fit in with that structure. You know, like I'm thinking of people who, if you had to describe their minds as more natural, like more like a tree, like growing like a leaf, you know, something organic and natural. And to them, the angles of the letters and the required sounds and and having to spell the word the same way every time didn't seem necessary, you know. And then them ending up to be some of the most beautiful people I know, you know, like that. So I'm thinking about education. I'm thinking definitely not to force.
Hi, Juju.
Children into a certain mold. I think that's what I'm trying to say, because that's a sort of judgment, right? Then that's a judgment about whether it's good or bad to fit in exactly to the what everyone else is doing. You see what I mean? And then that leads to the question of being judgmental of others. You see, to require a child to spell like everybody else and to draw their letters like everybody else. I hit a teacher in the fifth grade. You guess her name. You know her name?
Mrs. Butts.
Mrs. Butts, okay? I mean, and in the fifth grade, this is really funny, you know? And, you know, I had really good teachers up to Mrs. Butts. And then she was like crazy. And then she had like, what was it? We had to get up and sing Ode to Spring every morning. And then we had to memorize all the states and their capitals. And if you missed one, you got really, you know, if you missed one capital of one state, you got a C or something like that. So most of the year was spent struggling to memorize the 50 states and the capitals, you know, and of each state. And it was very traumatic, you know. Then the final exam, you know, like 30 really scared kids in the room trying to remember the capital of Nebraska and stuff, or trying to remember Nebraska. And then she had this thing about handwriting. And I had handwriting and everybody could read it. And it was okay. It was kind of vertical, you know. The L's went up straight. And the M's were like straight, you know. And then she had this thing about classical British handwriting, where it had to be just the right thing, and the F had to go with this scroll, and then it had to come back with this little scroll thing, and Q, nobody knows how to make a Q. It's a thing like this, and then you had to have a flourish at the end. And she fought with me the whole year, you know. Like I was a good student, I was a straight-A student, and she fought with me to handwrite in a certain way, and really made my life unpleasant, really hard, my life. So, in a way, you see, that's a statement about judging people. You see, like that's a statement about what's good and what's bad, and then that naturally extends to personal relationships, right? So then, as teachers, you demand a certain conformity. And then as a parent, you demand a different kind of conformity. You demand that they act in a certain way. And then by demanding that, you're making a statement about how other people act, about how you're making a statement about whether it's good or bad how other people act. So there was this thing I remember. I think C.S. Lewis talks about people who would go. Children in Britain when he was writing in the 40s, 1940s. And then he said there would be this thing where children would go to another home and they'd have a fish knife to cut fish, right? Mm-hmm. And then the children would say, that's not the kind of fish knife we have. You know, like, your family has a different kind of fish knife than we have. And your family's fish knife is wrong. You know, because my family has the right kind of fish knife. And the children would start to grow up like that. And in my experience, and having talked to people, it comes naturally from the way the parents are judge other people. You see what I mean? So if the parents are talking in terms of other people's fish knives, then it infects the child. And then they become people who are intolerant of other people who don't fit a norm. And then in a way, we teach it to them in school because they must draw their letters in a certain way. You know what I mean? And they must spell a word in a certain way. So okay, you spell middle a little bit differently. You spell it M-I-D-L-E. And it's obviously you know what it means. And it's okay. Like in Tibetan, they have dumkas, right? You know dumka? Dumka is like you can spell a word two or three different ways. And it's dumka means optional. You know, like you can spell it that way or you can spell it that way, you know. And people say, oh, that's a dumka, you know. And either one is okay. So I think as a parent, I'm thinking as a parent, you know, how much tolerance for diversity, how much tolerance for being different, can a parent display? You see, because they're not going to listen to all your lectures about Daksha and Yamje and treating others like yourself. They're not going to listen to that. They'll just watch what you do. And then how accepting and how embracing are you of difference, right? And then they will do what you do. They will learn to do what you do. So my experience is just observing children, they tend to be as tolerant as their parents, right? They tend to, if you, in the debate ground, in the monastery, you go to the winter debates, and you are, most often you're set against a competing monastery. What do you call it? A rival monastery. So the big deal for Saramay monks is they'll put you against a Saramay monk, you know? And then, each college, Saramay, in my day, had maybe five great teachers who were teaching all the classes. And then Sarah J had the five also. But then when you get into the debate ground and you start debating a guy, after about 3 minutes, you know who his teacher is. And you don't need to know, he doesn't have to tell you who his teacher is. You can tell from the quality of his debating, you can tell from his ideas, you can tell from how well he was trained. You say, oh, your teacher is Genjam, Jampa, you know, and you say, yeah, how'd you know, you know? He said, just from how you debate, I know. So, it's my experience that, you know, I have lots of students, right? In my life, I've had lots of students. And then, sometimes you meet the parents, right? And then you see where the, no, after 5 minutes of talking to the parents, you know where the quality of the child has come from, you know? And mostly it's pleasant experience, you know? Like, you'll meet a parent and you'll say, they'll seem really cool, you know? They'll seem somebody really cool. I'm thinking of Bliss's mother or Alicia's mother, right? And you meet them and they're just really cool. They're cool people. And then you say, okay, that makes sense, you know? I know where that came from. So I think with regard to judging other people or how tolerant they are of differences in the world, it's something that is passed down very closely. And how tolerant you are how embracing you are of other kinds of people is something that you learn largely from your parents. So and then to me that stretches to education. You see, so how tolerant are you of different states of mind? And just some people as young children, or some people as 40-year-old Dharma students, they're not going to fit in this keyhole, you know? What do you call it? Buttonhole. They're not going to be the standard Dharma student, you know? Maybe they will exhibit behavior which is different, you know? And I'm proud of Diamond Mountain in a way I think we're pretty accepting of a wide range of student behavior. You know, up to time it gets, you know, harmful for somebody. But I think to be tolerant of even gross differences in thinking and in, what do you call the cognize things, how people cognize things. Like people just might not see a letter in the way you see a letter. Or they might not feel that it's important to spell something the way you spell it. You see what I mean? And then maybe after a few years of knowing them, you discover that they have this deep, deep, deep sensitivity to some... I'm thinking of one person who has this deep sensitivity to colors. You know? So they don't spell very well. Right? But then we would take a walk or we would be talking with each other, and then they'd just stop and they look at a tree and they say, look at the leaves, you know? And you're like, yeah, you know, there's leaves, you know? And they said, no, look at the colors, you know? And you're like, yeah, there's some of the green, some are yellow, you know? No, but look at all the yellows, you know? And then you realize that they are having some very rich experience that you're not capable of. Right, so like you can spell better, and you're better with the kind of structure that counts in school right now, but then they are having this other, almost mystical experience of other things, and that's why their mind's not on the spelling. You know? Like to them, spelling would be a distraction, and it's not interesting to them, and it's not beautiful to them, and they're wrapped up. They're engrossed in some higher kind of beauty all around. And you're not even noticing it. So I think Lama Christy and I had a chance. We went to Seattle. I don't know if you remember, on the Heart Yoga Tour. And there was a lady who had an autistic son. And she brought him to the talks. And then she said, would you come to my house? Would you come to my house one night? And I don't know why, like years later, we looked her up and we went to her house. And we spent the night there. And then we informed her that we would teach the autistic child yoga. We spent some time and we said we figured out some yoga that would be good for your child. And then, you know, we spent a very frustrating afternoon trying to get the child to do the yoga, you know. And then some of that they did, and we felt like, oh, that would help them, their body physically, right? And then she said, okay, I don't remember the child's name, it's like Johnny. And she said, well, Johnny, why don't you play them some piano, you know? And he's like, okay. And he could barely walk to the piano. And he couldn't speak, right? He couldn't speak. And then he went to the piano and he played this incredible classical piece without any music, you know? He just, this with feeling and beauty and we're just like stunned, you know? And then it occurred to me, well, maybe he's just paying attention to something else so deeply that speaking or writing doesn't mean so much to him. That kind of structure doesn't mean so much to him. So then it makes you feel like, have I been judgmental? You know, like, did I judge the child? Because I did judge the child. I counted the child as less than normal. Right? From the time we met the child. But now you're seeing they have some kind of extraordinary beauty, which maybe I would give up my ability to speak, to hear like them. You see what I mean? And so I'm speaking in an average way and I'm hearing in an average way. They're speaking in a sub-average way so that they can hear in a supernormal way. Their attention is on how they hear, how things sound. And and it was beautiful. And then you're like, maybe I would rather be blind and be a great musician or something like that, you know? Maybe I would rather. So that then begs the question of judging other people. Like, how I'm thinking one of the most powerful things you can teach a child is how do you judge other people? To what extent do you judge other people? And count them as stupid or count them as less talented or like that. I'm thinking that's maybe the most important thing for a parent to focus on. How do you value other people as people? How do you judge their level like that? So that's the second thing. What was the first thing?
Recover.
Yeah. Yeah. So first thing was very low level. Like assuming the parent is gonna lose it sometimes. So how fast do you recover? How fast do you forgive? How fast are you the first one to hug the other one and say, okay, I'm sorry? You know, even if it wasn't your fault, right? That's basic level. Assuming you can't you can't control yourself. Okay? And then second level is okay, so you don't have gross negative emotions, but I think the most valuable example you can give to a child is how embracing are you of difference? How tolerant are you of difference, right? Because then I think that bridges to a higher level. That bridges to the ultimate practice for children, right? And the beginning of the bridge is to teach children to find good in other people, right? So, you know, when you are in the act of judging other people, how good are you at finding good in other people, right? And make that a habit, and demonstrate that habit to them with your everyday life, you know? Like, somebody says, he's autistic, and you say, but did you ever hear him play piano? You know, like, and you teach the child to look for the goodness in other people and instead of what's wrong with other people, because both are always there, right? There's always something wrong with other people. And there's always something beautiful with other people. So then it's just a question of which would you rather spend your time on? You know, do you want to concentrate on how irritating another person is, or do you want, they are equally talented at something, or they have some kind of beauty to them and some kind of high quality, right? So it's really always just a decision of which world do you want to be in? Do you want to be in the world of constantly observing their faults? Which is not uplifting, right? Which is, what do you call it? What's the degrading? It's degrading to you to think of other people's faults, right? Then it pulls you down. The fact that you can observe or see someone's faults means that you have it, right? And it's interesting to you, and you can identify it because you have it. And then why spend the time on that when every person has some kind of high beauty in them, right? Every person has some kind of worthwhile thing in them. So I'm thinking, if you had to think of a lesson to teach children by example, it would be, can you constantly say something positive about everyone you meet? You know, can you, in front of this child, as a daily habit, say something positive about each person they encounter with you? So you're never like saying, oh, she's irritating, or she's kind of stupid, or she's kind of fat, or he's kind of ugly, or something like that. The focus of how you relate to others is to look for the good in them, and it's not to pretend they don't have bad in them. You're not trying to pretend they don't have bad in them. You're just choosing to concentrate on the beauty. And then your mind becomes more beautiful, and then your child changes, right? Your child becomes someone who sees beauty around them, because they've seen it as a habit in you, right? So that's a like step two, right? And then to me, it bridges to step three. I had a lady, she was very distraught at the time. And she grabbed me and she took me in the corner and she said, my daughter died, you know? Which is like the, I'm gonna cry. It's the worst thing that could happen to a parent, right? I saw it happen to my brother died before my dad died. So I watched it, I watched how much it hurt him, you know, to watch his son die. And I don't think there's anything that hurts more than to lose your own child, right? And so she was in a really bad place. And she said, well, what can I do, you know, what should I do? And I don't know why it came to me. I wasn't practicing it, and I wasn't planning it, and I didn't know she was gonna say, I didn't know she had lost her child. And she just popped it on me, like, what should I do? And I came in my head, I was like, oh, I know exactly what you should do. And she's like, what? And I said, start a journal. And every day, write down things that your daughter did while she was alive that you would now consider indications that she was a divine angel, that she was a divine being sent to help you, you know? So write down, keep a journal, and just write down things that you recall, you know, make it a practice for 6 months or a year. Write down things about your daughter that might have been coincidence and might have been signs that she was a divine being and that she was purposely sent here for you. You know, and then she went away and I'm like, I don't know where that came from. And then I would get emails like every 6 months or so, you know, and she would describe, she'd say, yeah, you know, I did go over when she was six, she did this, and when she was eight, she did this, and you're absolutely right, you know, the odds that she was some kind of non-human being who was sent here to this planet to help me, it becomes more and more obvious that that's correct. And so she spent this whole, she worked her way out of her grief this way for years. I think she's still doing this practice. And now she has this beautiful, it has changed her, you know? It has changed her personality. And once you break through the ice, to break the ice with one person, like once you accept the possibility that one person in your life might be more than a human, then naturally it starts to happen with other people, right? So like Winston and Andrea, two old friends. So they had a boy. He was conceived during a diamond cutter teaching. They were in a tent, I remember. next door to IMS, do you remember?
Yeah.
And they told me, you know, he was conceived in the middle of the sixth class or something, you know, I'm like, wow. And then they had a baby, and I remember I was teaching at the Quaker House on 15th Street, and they came up with Kieran in their arms, you know. And Kieran looks at me, you know, he's like, oh, he's just in Andrea's arms. He looks at me and he goes like this, he goes. You know, like three times or something. And I'm like, wow, this is weird, you know. And I don't remember how, but then we took a photo that night or something. And there was a one-way sign with an arrow. And it looked like it was something cool going on, something really weird going on. And then Andrea was like, well, Geshe-la, do you have any advice for how I should raise the child, you know? And I'm like, why don't you do this thing that Pat is doing about her daughter, you know? Why don't you keep my mom kept a baby book for me. By the time she got to the fourth boy, she just quit. But I was number two. So number one had a pretty good baby book. I had a really good baby book. And then the fourth brother didn't have one because she was too tired. But it was really cool to have that. I think Annie Pelma stole my baby book. But it's really cute and it's really funny. There's all the report cards and pictures, you know, cool stuff. And it's big, it's like that, you know. And then, so I said to Andrea, why don't you keep a baby book, a different kind of baby book, and why don't you watch for any signs of abnormality, you know? Watch for any sign that this child is special. You know, and every parent thinks their child is special already. So, like, if you tell them to make a list, it's like throwing gasoline on a fire, you know? And then they're like, every parent I know, they come up to me at some point or another in the child's life, they come up to me and say, they like confide in me. You know, Geshla, there's something about my child. And I'm like, are they all right? They said, yeah, they're all right. And just, you should know one thing. And I'll say, what? And they'll say, well, they're really the smartest kid in their school, you know? And, you know, like that. And every parent does that. And then they show me these photographs of little lumps of flesh, and they say, my baby's the most beautiful, you know? And they look like the same little round, pudgy things to me. But in this practice, which is a tantric practice, okay? There's two stages of tantric practice, right? Kirin and Dzogchen. And the first stage tantric practice, you watch for signs of divinity around you, right? It becomes your practice. You become like, what's that Rinpoche's favorite TV show? The guy, the detective guy.
No,
Peter Falk.
Columbo.
God, he loved Columbo. You know, he watched it religiously. You know, like you couldn't get near his room on Wednesdays. It's from 7 to 8. You know, like just forget it. You know, it could be a fire in the temple, or you know, you could discover a new text in India, and he'd be no Columbo's on. You know, and so you have to be like Columbo, you know, how he just walks through a room and he sees 6 pieces of evidence that nobody else sees, and he can already conclude who the murderer is. And Rinpoche would say, he would say about Kirin, he'd say, you have to be like Columbo. And you're like quiet, you know how Columbo's like saying, did you have a good day, Mrs. Smith? And she'd say, yes. And then he'd say, you know, did you have a nice lunch? And she say, what'd you have for lunch? And she'll say, I had, you know, salad. And then he'll say, did you kill your husband? And then, and then he'd say, you have to be like that. You have to be kind of cool and not too obvious about it. And then you have to walk through the world and look for signs that other people are divine, you know? And you're just collecting clues like Columbo, and you're not playing, you're not showing your, what do you call it, cards? You're not showing your hand. You're just kind of walking through and you're just checking out things, you know? So you have to be like that with your child, okay? And then I made a deal. If you're somebody's main lama, which means their spiritual mentor or something, we have a main lama system. So I'm not allowed to have more than 12. I'm not allowed to be a main lama for more than 12 people. What it means is you have somebody you can call when you're having a spiritual crisis or something. And so it's not that 700 people, I'm trying to take care of 700 people on that level. So we have a Nei Lama pyramid scheme. And you don't have more than 12 people that you're on call for. If they have a crisis at 3 a.m., they can call you. So I don't want to have 700 of those. I limit it to 12, okay? But maybe you work out if you're someone's Nei Lama, and they're having a child, or they have a child, then I think it would be worth it to, teach them this practice. And people come to me and they say, Geshe Michael, I'm having a child. You know, and I used to tell Lama Christie, first they would say I'm getting married, and then Rinpoche would always tell me, they're getting hanged, you know? Like they're dead, you know? And I say, what do you mean, Rinpoche? Say, dipsit le de yure, which means it's a naughty thing to say. I shouldn't translate, maybe.
No,
Nah. Anyway. It just means that once you're in a heavy romantic relationship, your spiritual aspirations sometimes get sidetracked. Okay, but it's some kind of naughty way of saying it. And then when somebody got married, he'd say, oh, they got hanged. You know, there was a hanging today. And I'd say, what do you mean? He'd say, I mean, somebody got married. And I'm like, okay. And then somebody would have a child. And Rinpoche would say, that's over. Their life is over. You know, their life is over. They can't do anything. But then later I was in the room one day and someone came in and they said, I'm having a child. And he said, okay. And they said, he said, sit down. And she said, I'm pregnant, you know. First of all, there was a discussion about abortion. And he talked her out of it. And later she had the child and she said it was the best thing in her life ever. You know, but anyway, she came and said, you know, now I'm not going to be able to practice anymore. And he said, no, you don't understand. Your child is your practice now. You know, he said, you're not going to have time to meditate. They're going to be disturbing you all the time. You won't be able to go on retreats because it's not responsible to leave your child for that long. And basically, they're just going to be, that's it, you know. Your whole time is going to have to be poured into your child. I have a friend, a close friend who had two children. And she and her husband helped me get a retreat cabin a couple of times. And then they would bring my groceries. And then, so one time I said, I wrote them a note. I said, my retreat's ending next week. I'll watch your kids. I'll watch the two boys. For a day or a night, they'll spend overnight. I'll watch them the next day. You go on a honeymoon, what do you call it? Second honeymoon or something. You go to a bed and breakfast and make out or whatever, you know? And then, so they said, that's really, we thank you very much because we never get a break. And then the boys came and God, it was torture, you know? And you know, I had prepared all these things for them to do. Like we were gonna make Mongolian mousetraps together. And then we were gonna go through a hike to the woods and see a lake, and I had the whole day planned out, you know. And then it was like brutal. It was really, she wasn't wise after a later, I think. But I distinctly remember a moment when I said to them, okay, boys, I have to go pee-pee, I have to go poo-poo, you know. And I went in the bathroom and I locked the door. And then they're banging on the door, you know, and I can't concentrate on the poop, you know. And they're like banging on the door and yelling at me to open the door. And I'm thinking, you know, just give me 5 minutes, you know, like amuse yourselves for 5 minutes because I'm pooping, you know, and it takes a certain kind of concentration. They didn't give it to me. They wouldn't leave. They wouldn't stop banging the door. And I couldn't get out because it was only halfway done. And it was just really uncomfortable, you know. And then I thought, oh, my God, they do this every day, you know. They do this every day all year, you know. My friends, you know. Oh, my gosh, you know. How much... they're exhausted. They're totally exhausted because the children demand... I don't know everybody's children. I don't know about other children, but these children demanded every iota of their attention. And then they were exhausted. And then Rinpoche would say to the parent, you're not going to be able to meditate like you used to. And you're not going to be able to go on retreats. And you won't have time to study. So now you have to devote yourself to tantric practice only. And that's observing your child for signs of their divinity is now your practice, is now your full-time practice. So then you're not resisting the child, you know? You're not resisting the experience. You're not saying, I'm not free anymore, I don't have any time anymore, they're taking all my time, I can't meditate, I can't practice. And then there was a time with one mother that he said, you're going to now have a better chance to practice than the people who are meditating. Mm-hmm. You know, he said, now you're really lucky because now it's natural for a parent to be very focused on their child. And now if you do it in such a way that you're watching for their divinity, you're way ahead of everybody else. You have a natural outlet for tantric practice that's forced on you, you know? So use it, ride it. The idea of tantra is to like ride a tiger, right? A tiger approaches you and tries to bite you, and you jump on their back and ride them, you know? And so that was what Rinpoche would say. He would say, once you become a parent, basically drop your other practices. You can keep up what you can, but your main practice should be kirim, practice with your child, observing there for divinity. And then what I found as someone's Ne Lama is encourage them to send you emails and say, send me once a week a summary of the cool things they've done. And then keep a baby book not of photos and not of report cards from school, but keep a baby book of miracles. You know, keep a journal of miracles that you've seen with your child. And once you start to notice a few, you'll notice more, because they are divine. Okay? Because they are divine. So, I mean, the end of Colombo's investigation is already known. He's going to discover that the child is divine. You know? And then you just have to... You have the fun of the... What do you call it? Detective work. You know, you're going to have the enjoyment of the detective work throughout the rest of your life. Okay? So that's to me, it's the three levels of parenting. Maybe eventually we could develop that as some kind of a program for parents. You know, like an extended program for parents, I think. And we had a grid program for children in Howell for, I don't know, 10 years. And those kids are unbelievable. Bob Chilton's wife was one of the first children, and she's extraordinary. So they were brought up with worldview of karma and emptiness since they were tiny. And then and two things happened with two of the children. So the cool thing about children is they believe everything you tell them. They actually believe what you tell them about karma and emptiness. So we taught them for like, I don't know, a year, 2 years, something. And then Sammy's friend died. One of the children's friend died he was riding a bicycle and got hit by a car. So then Sammy was sad for a while. And then, I forget the other child's name, but we were, this was like 12, 15 years ago. So we were sitting together at 6th Street, and I remember this very heavy afternoon where Sammy came in and I said, well, how are you doing, Sammy? And he said, today I'm really good. And I said, why? And he said, I was doing Tonglen for my friend, you know? And I said, so what kind of Tonglen did you do? He said, oh, I sent him a bicycle today, because he really liked bicycles. So I meditated all day, and I sent him a really good bike, and he really liked it, you know? And he was doing Tonglen on his friend. And then it was really hot, you know? And I forget the other child's name, but he was really special. And then I said, they said it's hot, and I said, I'm sorry, the air conditioner broke, you know? And then I said, well, I'll try to fix it. And I got up and I got some screwdrivers and stuff. And then the boy on the floor is like, no, Geshe Michael, don't waste your time. You know, and I said, why? What do you mean? And he said, that's not why it broke. You know? And I'm like, what do you mean? And he said, we didn't make places cool enough for other people in the past. And that's why the air conditioner broke. And you can try to fix it, but maybe you will and maybe you won't. You know? And if you really want the air conditioner to work, we have to make places cool for other people. You know, like they get it. They really get it. Kids get it before other people get it. So I think, personally, to indoctrinate children, to try to logically present to children the idea that the world comes from how they treat other people is really, really a sweet way to bring up a child. I think those kids are, the Sammy I met as an adult, and he's extraordinary. He's really extraordinary. He's really an extraordinary person, you know? So I would encourage you to do that. Last thing, okay, then we go to the movies, I think, because it's going to be crazy tonight. Last thing I wanted to talk about was, we talked about it last night, I think, or the night before, pratyahara, which is the effect of overstimulation on people. And for children, it's exaggerated, I think. So, you know, I haven't had children. But I've been able to contribute to the upbringing of some children in the course of my life. I've been like a godfather to some children. And so I got to participate to some extent in the bringing up of some children. And the experiment that they did, the big thing was, one of the big things was not to allow the children to see any television at all. Zero tolerance on television. Not allowing the children to see any television at all. Like in the home, there's no television. And nowadays that would extend to videos on the web. So I'm just presenting the possibility or the thought of what would a child be like if they were not exposed to television or that use of computers at all until they finished elementary school or something like that. Now in the home, there was no custom of using television or computer for the children. I thought it might be too extreme. I thought they might come out strange or something, you know? Or, you know, somehow deprived somehow, or stupid in a way, like other kids would be joking about a show like Columbo, and then they wouldn't have any idea what was being talked about, and somehow they would be deficient, you know? And I wasn't sure it was so wise, you know? But anyway, that's what we did, and no television at all. Zero tolerance. Like not saying 1 hour a night or something like that. There's just no television in the house. And then the experience was that the parents have to observe the same thing, you know? Like the parents have to observe the no television thing. And then what happens is now, I think the experience of parents in the modern world is you don't have enough time with your children, you know? You don't have time to be with your children. There won't be time. You have to work, you have certain things to do, they have to go to school. You only have a very, very limited time to interact with your children. And then if you engage in the use of television and video on computers and things like that, web surfing, and even cell phones to a certain extent, right? Then you're in this situation where you're in a room with somebody, it could be your kitchen of your home, and dad is staring into a computer screen, and mom is staring into a computer screen, and the child is watching a show on TV, and there's three people in a room, and they haven't talked to each other for a week. You know, they haven't really had a face-to-face, a human interaction for a week, you know? They are, each of them, staring into some screen. And that's not to mention the physical effect of the screen, you know, which is probably quite damaging. I think they will look back and say that these devices were quite damaging to human health, you know, over the long term, especially like, what do you call it? Wireless. Mm-hmm. It will be learned that it was very damaging to the body. And the effect of a screen, a computer screen, cathode rays, on a human being, I think there's a physical damage of the computer and what it does to your ability to concentrate and your attention span. But then there's a social damage of teaching children to be in a room and not interact with other human beings in the room at all. Like there's no human interaction going on. And then in the experiment that I was peripherally involved with, the children had no television up to high school. And they're beautiful, you know, they're really beautiful. And instead of television, they might go outside and go for a walk or see the stars, or they're into gardening, they plant things. So that the boy, one of the boys I saw recently, and he's in college now, and I went to his house, and he's with all his roommates, you know, and I said, well, you know, I'm just trying to check out to see if things are all right. Do they drink, you know, beer or anything? And they said, no, they don't drink at all. I said, well, what do you guys do for fun? And he says, well, we do our garden, you know. I have a garden out back, and we grow vegetables for dinner. That's what we do, you know. And he was put into a house with normal college frat guys. And now the whole frat is like doing gardening in the evening. and they're like, look at these squashes, we can make really good pies, and you know, and we're really, and you know, it's so healthy. And they're so mentally, what do you call it? Healthy. Their mental health is very high. And their level of happiness is unprecedented. You know, I haven't seen that level of happiness. And they had no familiarity with modern, what do you call them? They call them devices now. On the airplane, they say, shut down your devices. They don't say, shut down your computer anymore. They say, because there's so many, they say, shut down your devices. And then I told the story last night. I went to breakfast with a good friend of mine from the diamond business. He's discovered cell phones, computers, iPod, email. And I felt really sad because I haven't seen him for maybe 6 months. And I waited for 3 days to have a meal with him. And then we finally went to a meal and he was on this iPod the whole time. And now it seems to be a normal, it used to be like a couple years ago that people would apologize and they would excuse themselves from the table and they would go outside and they would take their phone. It was a bit like smoking a cigarette. But now it's just people comfortably lapse into ignoring each other when they've gone out to dinner to talk to each other. And very automatically and very smoothly, they both pull out their cell phones and completely ignore each other for half the meal or something. And it's not considered impolite. It's considered normal. Even if there's nothing very important, like nobody's dying, it's just they want to check their email. And so I would propose, just from my own experience, no TV, no computer use, aside, I don't know if there's some necessary for school, for writing compositions or something, as a word processor. And no cell phone up to a certain age. And you will, I believe you'll find that they come out much, much better people for it. They come out really good. That's what's happened. Really, really good. The one boy was homeschooled most of his education, and then he went to high school the last couple of years. And they voted him class president the moment, you know, after a couple of weeks he got there. And they made him class president because he's just so friendly and so human. And he's able to look you in the eye and, or hug you, you know, and he doesn't ignore you. And, you know, he's been actually accustomed to human interaction and love, you know, like warmth, right? So just as a practical thing, I would suggest that. So now, so what do you have? I'll summarize. You have, if you lose it with your child, I mean, especially at them, right? But even with other people, you make an example of how fast you can forgive, right? What was the second thing?
Tolerance.
Yeah, a high degree of tolerance. You exhibit a high degree of tolerance for difference. And you look for the good, and you, with the tolerance goes looking for the fine qualities of other people. And that automatically bridges to what?
Divinity.
Yeah, seeing the divinity in other people. So then you keep a journal of your child's divinity. They will observe you doing it. The flavor, the rasa of you trying to see divinity in your child and keeping a journal of it. And that they'll become aware of what you're doing at some point, right? Even if you don't announce it formally, they'll be aware of the exercise. And then what happens to them? Two things. I mean, to have someone consider you a divinity, people tend to respond to whatever people put on them. The people project llama onto me, and then I do the llama thing, right? So if you're looking for them to do something sacred, they'll start doing sacred stuff, you know. But then again, they'll learn the habit of what you're doing, you see? And they will look for sacred things. They will say, Mom and Dad, we're always looking for the divine in me. That's, and they seem to be pretty happy. Or they'll automatically do what you do. If you judge other people negatively, they'll do that. If you're trying to see the divine in them, they'll start doing that to other people. So on two counts, you have a beautiful child, right? They are responding to being the divinity trip being put on them, and then they're learning to do what you do to see other people as divine. So what was the last thing? What was the side thing?
Pratyahara.
Yeah, pratyahara in the sense of consider the possibility of raising children in a device-free atmosphere where you encourage and you undertake one-on-one warmth and one-on-one human contact with them often. Because the time you have available during the day is limited, and the time you have before they leave you is limited. So have as many warm interactions as you can. Use the time that way. So I've used up all the time. We're going to have a 10-minute baby shower. Is that all right? What are you doing in baby shower? I don't know. You sit up here, right?
Yes.
And we bring you nice presents and
yes.
stuff. I have, yeah.